Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch. I'm Sue Rocco. Thanks so much for joining me. This week, my guest will be Atiya Abawi. And Atiya is an international journalist. She is an author and she is an activist. And she's going to be telling us about her 5 years spent reporting in Afghanistan during wartime and why she made that decision to go back there after her family actually fled Afghanistan. Don't forget to stay with us during the breaks, where you'll hear from our exclusive watch team of corporate partners. And please be sure to follow us on our YouTube channel at W2W Media. So now I'm very honored and excited to welcome to the show Atiya Abawi. Atiya, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm very excited to have you on. I think you've had an incredibly fascinating career, one in which I'm particularly interested in. And of course, it's all about storytelling and the human spirit. And I thought we would start the interview talking about, right off the bat, your time spent reporting in Afghanistan, because what I find fascinating is the fact that your parents actually were born there, and then your mother fled during wartime to Germany. And then here you decide as a professional to go back there and work. And I wondered, you know, talk a little bit about that decision and then a little bit about your time there.
Yeah, absolutely. So my mother and father, they escaped Afghanistan during the first of the many wars, recent wars, I should say. And by recent, I mean last 4 decades. My mother was 8 months pregnant with me. It was a very difficult decision for them to make, no doubt. It was a land of their ancestors. You know, that was home. That was their foundation. Unfortunately, the war with the Soviets at the time was getting worse, and my parents were not communists, and that was particularly bad for them at that moment, because both of their fathers were generals pre-communism. So that actually made them into a target. They had family members who turned against them because they did join communism. They had strangers who helped them. There's a story that I like to share when I talk to students primarily who don't know much about war, and I try to make them understand how difficult it is for someone in wartime. There's a story about how my parents made the decision that it's time to go. The war was getting bad. Their lives were in jeopardy and their children's lives, including their unborn child. My brother was 2.5 at the time. My dad, every day, his job was to get the visas for the passport. And every day he'd go to the passport office, and every day he was rejected and told to come back the next day. He did that for about 6 months when finally someone within the office felt bad for him and said, you know, you're never going to get these visas. Someone's blocking you. You have to go above our office. He eventually went to the ministry. Come to find out, it was his own cousin who was a communist. And wow. At the time, he was blocking him. And then I tell the story about how strangers then become saviors. My mom, her job was to get the tickets because, you know, we talk about Afghan women. Unfortunately, today, when a lot of people think of Afghan women, they think of the blue burqa, they think of oppression. They don't understand how strong Afghan women really were. And even back then, my mother was the breadwinner. And she was the top accountant for Ariana Airlines, which was partnered with Pan Am at the time. And her job was to get the tickets. So my mother had to get a sign off from her Afghan boss and a sign off from the American boss for the Pan Am. And the boss for Pan Am said, "You're never coming back, are you?" And my mother could not lie. So she just stared at him and he just said, "I wish you and your family the best future." And he signed off on her ticket. He did that for dozens of other families and saved all of these Afghan families. And then he himself was then murdered 3 years later for helping everyone, including my family. That said, they eventually did make it out. I'm shortening the story because it's even much longer. They landed in Germany, where I was born a month later. And Germany back then, like today, kind of served as a bridge. So they allow refugees in, but they don't have the capacity to absorb all the numbers they allow in. So they help you go other places. And my mother had family in America, and that's where she wanted to come to be near them. And when I was one, we arrived in Northern Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C., where I was raised. And I was raised on the news because my parents always wanted glimpses of what's going on in their country and all around the world. And when I was watching the news, I realized some journalists did an amazing job and others didn't. And I remember thinking, and even watching stories in Afghanistan or whether it be other parts of Asia, Europe, South America, Africa, I wanted to see what was happening because I wanted to really know what was happening on the ground. And that's when I realized I either wanted to go into the State Department or become a journalist. And then in high school, I took a journalism class and I fell in love with it.
Yeah. You shared with me that you knew from a young age, and I was curious what your first exposure to it was. And when you say that some did well with their job and some did not, are you referencing the information they were bringing? They weren't answering questions that perhaps you had, or just not particularly doing a good job as a journalist?
So I think this is an issue that we have today. We've had it in past years, and we're definitely going to have it in the future as well. I think that there's a lot of journalists who go in for ego, for the wrong reasons. And everyone's allowed to have a little bit of ego, but when it affects the story, that's when it really, as a consumer of media, it really bothers me because I feel like the people that we should be helping, and maybe this is naive of me to feel this way. I know when I was younger, I felt even strongly, and I look back and I'm like, maybe I was naive. But I genuinely feel that a reporter's job, a journalist's job, is to be the voice for the voiceless, for the people who really need their voices heard. And quite often, those are the voices we ignore to make connections within the government, within the military, no matter what country you're at, within organizations. But it's the actual everyday citizens of a country, whether it be here, whether it be there, that are affected by the policies made. And we need to get their perspective to really understand what's going on. And back then and today, there are some great journalists who give us that perspective. And then there are others who don't. And I think that's unfortunately a flaw in some parts of journalism.
Yeah. I can't imagine the fear that particular mom had leaving her home and starting all over. And I wonder if they spoke to you when you were younger, after you moved to the United States, did they talk about their time in Afghanistan or did they kind of want to put it behind them?
Actually, they talked about it a lot. In fact, they kept one of our languages. My parents spoke a couple of the languages of Afghanistan fluently. It was difficult to keep both alive in the household, so they focused on one. And then they would use the other one as a secret language when they were trying to hide things from us. I would pick up on it after spending a summer with my grandparents who spoke the other language. And then I'd come home.
Right.
And for a few months, I'd understand. And then it would fade again. But they made sure we kept at least one of the languages alive in the household. We were only allowed to speak to each other in that language because they knew that we would learn English in school. And they were on top of us at school as well to do well there. And they even on Saturdays, I was sent to an Afghan school where I learned how to read and write. I will say my reading and writing is probably at a very young kid's level, but, you know, they tried. And they always imagined that after the war ended with the Soviets, you know, we would go back. So they wanted to make sure we knew the language, that we knew how to read and write. Unfortunately, when it comes to Afghanistan, one war led to another war, which led to another war, and it's been 40 years of war. And I always say this about refugees and immigrants. It's not that they want to just, I'm going to come over, I'm going to live on your land, I'm going to take what you have, and I want it for myself. It's out of desperation. It's out of survival. And they're grateful to be helped. but home is home for them. And they eventually have a dream of going back. But unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. And they're always grateful for the place that they do arrive, you know. And I wrote a book about the Syrian refugee crisis. And I'm a strong believer of this as someone who was a refugee, who has friends who are refugees, who were immigrants. These are great people that come in that can help build our country. My parents worked really hard when they came here to provide a living for us. And then eventually, you know, they paid back. My mother became a language teacher to State Department employees, you know, in the last 20 years in the war in Afghanistan when the U.S. was involved. My dad taught the Marines language skills as well. So, you know, we need to help build a foundation for a lot of these people whose foundations have been broken. So I'm a genuine believer of that. And I mentioned this only because, again, I talk about refugees a lot. The numbers are growing every year. There's 10 million more displaced people. I've noticed this statistically right now. I think we're at 120 million in the world displaced. Refugees are rising. And with climate change, war, poverty, we're going to see more. And I'm a believer that if we work together, we can build a safe world for all of us. But if we don't, it becomes a scary place for all of us.
The conflict there and throughout the Middle East is so incredibly complex. And there's a lot of myths. And I'm sure, you know, as Americans who have never been over and seen firsthand what you have, I'm sure we don't know the truth of things. And the two questions I have for you regarding that, you know, if you can dispel some of the myths that Americans have that you hear about Afghanistan in particular, and then I wonder if there's a story that you were there almost 5 years, a story mm-hmm. that really has stayed with you all this time.
Okay, that's a good one, and there's a lot of stories, so I have to think about them. But when it comes to myths, one of the myths is that Afghan women are weak. They are not. Unfortunately, that's why you see a group like the Taliban trying to shut them out of society, because they know that they're probably the strongest part of society. It goes to that age-old adage, which is you educate a man, you educate a person, you educate a woman, you've educated a family. And in Afghanistan's case, you've educated a village, because they will teach other girls in their family and boys and their neighbors, their tribe, you know, their family. So the easiest way to have control over society is to shut down half of it. And in this case, the female half. I will say, when I was in Afghanistan, I would become insecure around a lot of these women, because they were so strong. They knew what they wanted. They worked hard for it. And the face of massive amounts of adversity, people trying to push them out down, they would rise up. In the 20 years where the Taliban were not in power, you know, we saw women back in politics. We saw women doctors. We saw women presidents of international NGOs, including the International Red Cross. You know, there was a female president until the Taliban took over. They were some of the strongest women I've ever encountered. So the biggest myth is that Afghan women are weak. They are not. In fact, they're the ones that are currently fighting the Taliban at the moment and fighting for their own rights, while unfortunately, a lot of people around the world are ignoring them. Another myth about Afghanistan is that, I mean, unfortunately in the news and photography, we only see the rubble and war. It's stunningly beautiful. It has such a stunningly beautiful landscape. I've seen purple, sparkly mountains, pink mountains flying overhead on helicopters, beautiful rivers. It's just a stunningly gorgeous country. And unfortunately, it's a country that has gone through a lot in the last 40 years. And the last myth, I'll give three. There are more myths to it, but you know, it is a primarily Muslim country. And I think this myth goes around through the whole Muslim world. They're not our enemies. You know, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, no matter what religion, even beyond the Abrahamic religions, they all have a very similar core. And that is
goodness, helping humanity, helping each other, helping your neighbor. Unfortunately, within every religion, there are good people and bad people. And what we're seeing in many religions right now is the bad people use religion as a tool, manipulate it, and that's what happens, and that's what creates groups like the Taliban. I write about this a lot in my first book, The Secret Sky, because it goes into Afghanistan. It's a novel, but based on reality. But you know, it talks about this tug of war within Afghan communities and villages, where you had more than 1,000 years of a peaceful practice of the religion, to the last few decades where extremism has taken over and this power struggle with it.
It's so incredibly sad. You know, I wish that what you described we could see more of. Visually, you're right. There's always the focus on the bad. You know, it people tend to be more interested in that. Did you feel safe there? I mean, again, my perception of going there and reporting would be frightening. Mm-hmm.
It was frightening, and there were a lot of dangers involved. There are still dangers involved. A lot of people will say that it's actually a safe time for Westerners to visit right now. It's not for Afghan people. I think that the Taliban are right now welcoming Western tourists because they need the money and they do keep them safe, but it's not safe for Afghans. At the time, in the 20 years of the international involvement, it was very dangerous and it was very scary. There were multiple times that I can honestly say that I thought I could have died. You know, bullets whizzing just a few inches from my face, stepping on an IED that luckily did not go off. My husband stopping at a grocery store, realizing, oh, you know what, I don't have any money, decided to leave. 2 minutes later, that grocery store was attacked and shot up, and then an explosion. Wow. And everyone inside was killed. So it's little moments that can save you, inches that can save you. And sometimes it's just pure luck. That said, one of the biggest dangers for me didn't even come from the war itself. It came from a jealous colleague who was not happy to have a female boss, you know, or a female reporter there, and thought he should be the one. And finding out from, we lived in a house where NBC News was on the third floor, which is where I lived. And then CBS was on the first floor. And the cameraman for CBS overheard the local guards talking about attacking me. And he told the CBS correspondent, who was a good friend of mine, she was a Canadian journalist, and she told me, we told our British security guards, and they did an investigation, and come to find out the person who was leading these men into doing that was my own colleague that was sitting next to me the entire time. So oh for me, gosh, that was the most frightening situation.
Wow. Atiya, tell me what is at the very core of your decision to stay there with that kind of environment, that kind of work, that kind of fear. Why is it so important to you? What is it that drove you then to stay there when someone else might have said, you know, I will not put my life at risk?
So what drove that moment is exactly what drove me before even arriving in Afghanistan. And there was, I was at CNN at the time, and they decided to open up a bureau in Kabul. And there were a lot of people who wanted the job. You know, this was their chance. And I realized that the people who wanted it, for the most part, didn't want it to try to help the people involved, whether it be the Afghans, the soldiers who are risking their lives there, you know, the civilians, everyone. They wanted it for their chance to become famous. And I thought that was such a disservice to the Afghan people, to the families that are sending their sons off to war. That doesn't help the situation. Again, it goes back to this thought that I had that as a journalist, you can make a difference. And I do think that sometimes we can. A lot of the times we can when we're sharing the truth of what's going on. So my motivation, honestly, was to get the real story out. That's
the truth.
Kind of the truth, yeah. And that's sometimes difficult to do because on television, you have at the most 2 minutes. Sometimes on nightly news, I had 41 seconds to tell a story. If I wrote a .com piece, I only had 750 words. And again, that's not enough time, not enough words to tell the whole story. But that's also part of the reason why I transitioned to writing realistic fiction as well. So for anyone who's interested, they're able to pick up the book and be able to know what's going on. And I know it's not a topic that most people are interested in picking up when they want to pick up a novel. So when they do, I want it to be as true, as close to the truth as possible.
Yeah. Listen, we're going to go into our first break. And when we come back, I want to talk about the work you're doing today, all of the important work that you're doing with women and students around diversity and the importance of empathy. Stay with us for our watch team, and I'll be right back with Atiya Abawi.
Hi, my name is Christy McCaffrey. I'm the founder and owner of Be the Good Media, and I'm here to share some good news with you. Today, I wanted to share with you about a guest that I had on my podcast named Jen Welby Gilbert. Jen is an elementary school teacher who says that she wants her students to know that they are never too young to make a difference and that they have the ability to change the world. After years of implementing her own program in her classroom to help her students understand the process and the value of giving and philanthropy, Jen went on to create her own nonprofit called The Giving Project for Children, where she's now created a curriculum that she shares with parents, teachers, and administrators to help encourage the study of philanthropy and giving in classrooms. How inspiring is that? That is some good news. To hear more of our conversation, you can visit BeTheGoodMedia.com. And there you'll also learn more about how Be the Good Media works to amplify impact-driven missions and causes. Again, I'm Christy McCaffrey. Listen here for more good news on Women to Watch.
Ladies, I'm Tiffany Curtin, a financial professional with more than 25 years of experience serving successful women, families, and businesses. Here's the reality. You don't have to be the one managing your family's finances to take ownership of your future. But if you want true confidence about how everything is going to play out, you do have to take part in the process. That doesn't mean digging the weeds of your finances when you don't have the time or desire. It means elevating your awareness of your own circumstances. It means having the bigger conversations so you're empowered when you need to be. Let's bring confidence to your family's future without overwhelming your time. Call Marcel at 903-520-2709. That's 903-520-2709. Or visit Johnson Financial Group on our website, www.jfg.cc. Not .com, www.jfg.cc.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 executives through my work at the EXCO Group, firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior leaders grow. Today on Leadership Watch, we're going to talk about being in the driver's seat of your career. No matter what stage you're at in your career, you need to grasp that you are in the driver's seat. Understanding from day one that you and you alone are responsible for your career is critical. After all, why would you hand your career over to someone else to manage? There's no one as vested in yourself as you, and the ugly truth is that most managers are focused on execution rather than team development. So how can you ensure that your career stays on track? First, make sure you have a clear set of agreed upon goals that are measurable, and if priorities shift, rewrite them with buy-in. Two, if you see something that can be improved upon or automated, don't wait to be asked, just do it. This is good advice for tech-savvy millennials and Gen Zs who can help lead the way with AI. Three, don't insulate yourself. Get to know other parts of the organization and network both internally and externally. Feel free to drive outside of your lane. And four, while your career is yours to own, don't go it alone. Identify sponsors and mentors. Also, it's important to make self-reflection and self-assessment a habit. Think through where you want to be 5 years from now and create a roadmap for yourself. Does your current path get you there? Are you passionate about what you're doing? Do you feel challenged? Are you learning? Do you feel respected? And importantly,
finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Are you a cultural fit? And is the company a cultural fit for you? If you answer negative to any of these questions, it's likely time for some course correcting. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, check out expoleadership.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined this week by Atiya Abawi. And Atiya is an international journalist. She is an author and she is also an activist. And I want to give you time to talk about the great work that you're doing today in having conversations, important conversations, speaking to young people, and particularly women, talking about women's rights. So if I were to say to you, what keeps you busy today, how would you describe that?
Besides my children.
Besides the fact that you're a mother. Yes.
Yeah. What keeps me busy today is that I go on a lot of speaking engagements. A lot of them are at high schools and schools around the country. There are universities as well. But what I do primarily is speak about empathy through my career as a journalist, as an author, and my travels around the world, and kind of sharing the stories of the people that I've met in a way where they can connect with them, especially in today's society where, you can pick up your phone and you'll be on an algorithm and you will only hear what's going on in that algorithm. I feel like there's a new young generation that has an exposure to the world in a way that we didn't growing up. And it's really important for them to know how to digest all the information that's coming in and make sure it's accurate and not be pinned to one side and refuse to see the other side. Because unfortunately, what we're seeing everywhere right now is these divisions that's really causing problems in society, breaking up societies, whether it be in America and other countries. So my point in journalism, my point as an author, and my point as a speaker has always been about empathy. And I try to humanize people that they might not have met. A lot of these schools that I go to are, private schools. So they're not really exposed to refugees or immigrants in a way that someone like me, friends in my high school were exposed to people like me and my other classmates because we were a very diverse high school. So it's about sharing those stories, sharing the stories about being a woman in journalism, being a woman author. A lot of people think that by going to a country like Afghanistan, it's a hindrance to be a female reporter. But if anything, it worked for me in a way that my male colleagues, didn't have an advantage. For instance, I could talk to Afghan women. Afghan women would talk to me. They wouldn't talk to a male reporter because, cultural norms, their family wouldn't let them. Even Afghan men felt more comfortable talking to me than they did to a male journalist because they didn't always trust another man because they felt like the men had ulterior motives. But as a woman, they felt this comfort. So it works for you
as a female journalist in a lot of these countries that you would think it wouldn't. If anything, some of my biggest blocks when it comes to sexism would happen within the organization that I was working in, a Western organization like CNN or NBC. You know, the sexism would play there in a way that it wouldn't on the ground. And a lot of people don't talk about that. I talk to children and students about, you know, they meet bullies in high school, but, you know, we meet bullies throughout life, you know, and we have to learn how to deal with it and work past it and, you know, grow from it. And it's not just something that goes away when you finish school. And I tell them stories about the bullying I felt working for some of these organizations myself and how I had to fight through it, how it affected me mentally and emotionally in a war zone. When I should be thinking about my safety and telling a story, I'm stressing out about my job and, you know, being yelled at over the phone from headquarters over silly things. So, you know, right. I talk about that.
Yeah. I think you and I spoke about this when we first spoke over the phone in an introductory call about whether you can actually teach empathy to someone, or are you born empathetic, an empathetic human being, and that's who you are, and other people are not? Because the word itself is different from compassion, sympathy. Mm-hmm. To be empathetic, right, is to feel what another is feeling. So I'm curious, what kinds of things do you say to the young people in particular around empathy and the need for it?
So that's the most challenging part, because we're all different people with different experiences. And I can't make someone be empathetic. I can't force it in them. I can't change right. their experiences. I can't change their mindset. But I can share stories, and I can let them have knowledge and then have a connection if they can make that connection. And it's not to say that every student does, or every person I talk to does. But it's about humanizing people that they quite often don't see as themselves, as fellow human beings. Unfortunately, that's the biggest problem we have. And I tell them, I was like, it's human nature to be afraid of things that you don't know. That is human nature. That's what protects us. It's survival. But we live in a world today where if something we think we're afraid of, for instance, someone from a different country, someone from a different religion, someone with a different skin tone, we have the opportunity to meet someone, talk to them, read a book, you know, go outside of the newspaper we pick up or the cable channel that we watch and flip around. We have access to all this information, to knowledge. And once you have understanding and knowledge, quite often that fear turns into empathy. Unfortunately, if you don't do that, that fear becomes hate when we don't go out of our way to try to understand the other. And I'm big on humanity and humanization. And, you know, I lived in Afghanistan. I lived in Jerusalem for 6 years. I met people from all sides, where it's so disheartening to see today where people will dehumanize another side and not see the fact that both sides are human beings. Both sides have families. Both sides have loved ones. And any kind of pain on either side is still human pain. And it's just something that we talk about. And, you know, I also enjoy listening to their stories. And it opens up my perspective. It opens up a conversation. You know, students that are going to some of these schools who don't connect with classmates. And once I share a story and they ask me questions, little by little, I can hear their stories too when it's in a smaller setting. And it becomes really a therapy session for all of us.
Yes, I think knowledge, you know, you use that word knowledge. I think it's so powerful to know more about people who are unlike us. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I worry, or not, I wonder, you know, human beings are by nature flawed. Mm-hmm. And some of the social issues that we have today, we have seen for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And if I were to ask you, can you see a world where there is more peace than war? It's a big question.
That is a really big question. I think it's possible. I think there is a lot more good in the world. Unfortunately, I do think that the good is drowned out by the loud voices of the bad. I think that to be realistic, and I'm not very kumbaya all the time. I'd like to be, but realistically, I think things are going to get worse before they get better. I do think it, you know, as you said, it's happened in the past. History is very cyclical. And we have moments where things get truly, truly bad and then slowly better. And as we're getting better, that cycle repeats itself. And I think that we're in the bad part of the cycle at the moment, unfortunately. I would like to think that it will get better soon, but I think that there will be some more hardship before things get better. And I hate to say that because I think about my kids, I think about your kids, I think about, you know, all of these like innocent, you know, children who are growing up in a world that's a pretty scary world at times. But again,
and they see it, right? That's that point of, I loved you said the word, trying to help young people digest the news. Mm-hmm. So they're consuming it. They're seeing it and hearing it every day, all day long. And they do need help in digesting it so that all of the things that are happening in the world, they can't take in, especially the ones who are truly empathetic, yeah. Empaths, right?
Yeah. We all need help digesting the news.
We all do. Yeah. Grown-ups. Yes, yeah. We do. And it is scary. When you look at your children, I believe you have a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old.
Yes. Yes.
Right? As your son is 9?
He is.
Is he in third grade?
He just started fourth grade, actually. Yeah. And my daughter's in fourth grade.
Yeah. So I'm wondering what you see in their interactions, just, you know, boys and girls in the classroom. How is it different, if at all, from your years in fourth grade growing up in school in Virginia?
Oh, that's a great question. So my son is what you would call, what you mentioned, an empath. He is very, very empathetic. We've been very open with him growing up about questions that he would ask about what's going on in the world. He knows he's half Afghan, which we call him a Halfghan. And he's genuinely interested. You know, I got him a subscription to Honest History magazine. He loves history. He loves learning about different cultures and different stories from around the world. I will give an example of what happened in first grade, which was a few years ago, but he came into school. He had just finished his Montessori, started public school, and his Montessori, he had best friends that were boys and best friends that were girls. And, you know, I've always told him that, you know, I was talking about different things that were going on at the time, including about an ally, about, you know, feminism, and, you know, do you want your sister, who was a baby at the time, to have equal opportunities as you? And he's like, yes. So when he started first grade, he was introduced to a boy who was really mean to the girls in the class and bullying the girls in the class. And it,
there's always one.
There's always one.
There's always one mean boy.
But I was really proud of him when he came home. He was really frustrated. He had this like anxiety about it all, but he would stand up to the boy and be like, leave them alone, leave them alone. And then that would, of course, upset the boy. And then the boy would get mad at him. And it became this issue. But as the years have gone on, that anxiety has changed into confidence and, you know, defending others who need to be defended. What's different from when I was a kid to when he's a kid? When I was a kid, you know, racism existed. There were times where I had that I didn't realize until I was much older that the reason the teacher didn't like me was probably because of this, instead of just me being like someone she didn't like. Finding out later, a lot of it had to do with race. A lot of it had to do with a prejudice they might have had. It was quieter when I was a kid. You know, you didn't know. He came home from his first week of school where one of the boys said something very racist to one of the girls. And they told the teacher, it was being dealt with. It was being dealt with the principal. But my son understands what racism is, why that was bad. So he approached the girl when he found out and he said, "I'm so sorry that he said this to you." And the girl appreciated that. And I think that's a bit of a difference, is that kids do understand a lot more of what's going on in our world. That I know as a kid, I didn't understand it until I was much older.
Yeah. Do you ever, do you miss reporting? Do you ever kind of have a thought about the excitement and the adventure of that?
I do miss it. It was such an honor to travel and meet people from all over the world and share their stories. It's a big responsibility, and I loved it. I loved meeting everyone. I don't know if the risk is worth it now that I have children and now that I'm a mother.
Right.
It changes a lot. You know, you think you have another responsibility now.
Correct.
I know my mother's heart and my father's heart would break every time I'd go to a war zone. I remember going to Iraq.
I'm sure. Yeah. I can't imagine as a mother having that worry.
You know, I can't.
And there's a lot of that today. There's a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't imagine that either. And I remember my mother crying when I was super excited that I was going to finally get my chance to go to the Iraq war and cover it and meet Iraqi people and see what was going on. And she cried on the phone and she was like, "I'm happy for you." And she's clearly sad. And then when I was in Afghanistan, my dad, who was not a very emotional man, God rest his soul, he's passed away since, but you know, my mother said the first time he saw me reporting from Kabul, he had tears, you know, going down his face. It was part pride that, you know, I was in the country that he grew up with, in the city that he called home for the longest time, and also fear. You know, it's definitely, yes. It wasn't the city that he grew up in. It was a new city, unfortunately, that was much more.
Right. Dangerous. Yeah. That conflict of pride and fear must have been a tough juggle for them.
Yeah.
By the way, your husband's a journalist as well.
Yes.
And did you meet in Afghanistan?
We did. In fact, we grew up 5 minutes away from each other in Northern Virginia. I was in Annandale. He was in Arlington. But we didn't meet until Kabul. That's
amazing.
And the funniest part is he actually used to drive my cousin to school in Northern Virginia when they were in high school.
And oh my gosh.
And we didn't know each other until Afghanistan. So that was interesting.
Yeah. Meant to be, I would say.
I would like to think so. Yes.
Yeah. My last question for you, when I think about, I know that you speak to women, and I think it's wonderful that you have had the opportunity to meet people from all different places and cultures, races. Do you think that women today in general, because everything is so open, you know, we're having conversations openly, you know, in public that years and years ago, things were kept more quiet, that women are finding their voices now more than ever? Just the fact that you're going to have conversations with your daughter, you know, a five-year-old little girl, that perhaps those conversations weren't had years ago, particularly in the U.S., I would say. Are you seeing women going out into the world more confident, using their voice, wanting to make a difference and bring about change?
I think so. And I think that's why there's so much pushback, unfortunately, all over the world, including here. I think the fact that, you know, women are more confident in sharing their wealth of knowledge, their capabilities, extreme capabilities, it's scared a lot of people. And that goes back to what I was saying about Afghanistan and the Taliban. What easier way to control a society by shutting off women from education, from the workplace, taking away their rights, is an easy way to control a whole society.
Because when you think about it, and again, I'll use Afghanistan as a example, but this example can take place here in America as well, or places in Europe. The example being that when you control half of a population, you're trying to control the women, but you're also giving the other half, the male half, a semblance of power. So
too much.
Well, they feel like, okay, I can help control women. So therefore they're not fighting above, they're fighting down. So they're trying to fight against women and their voices and their rights, instead of fighting about upwards to the people who are and the entities that control them as well. So in the case of Afghanistan, the Taliban are in power, they're in the government, they're taking away women's rights, they're taking away their right to education, to work, to even go outside of the home. And so the men who don't have great lives themselves, it's just an economic failure there right now. They're literally starving to death. But they feel like at least I have control over the women in my family. I can yell at a woman on the street and I'm still in charge. But they're not using that energy to fight upwards to the people who are holding back jobs from them, who are holding back food from them, who are closing them and shutting them off from the world. And I think that's just a really, really easy way to control everyone by shutting the women off. And I think that women's voices can be very terrifying for people.
I one more thing I wanted to say to you, because it struck, you said at the beginning of the show, you were talking about myths, and that there's a myth that women from Afghanistan are weak. And I would say that among myself and my peers has not been the case. It's actually, I think we have always looked at the Afghan women as incredibly strong because they have to be. We believe they're oppressed, but not weak. I think, you know, it's a different way to look at it, but I can only speak from my own personal experience. I have always viewed them as very, very strong, out of necessity even, but definitely oppressed, not weak.
Well, that's actually a fantastic thing to hear, honestly. And I think Afghan women would be appreciative to know that people do realize that they are strong, capable women and they are fighting. Yeah, they're literally dying. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. And I'm glad that you and your peers feel the same.
Yeah. Good. Well, listen, I enjoyed the conversation so much, and I appreciate your taking time and shedding light on a topic that, you know, is heavy and confusing and complex. And I wish you continued success with all the work that you're doing now. Any other books in the works? Do you have?
I'm supposed to schedule a call with my literary agent soon. So hopefully.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, let me know. I'll be sure to share.
Thank you so much, Sue. I really
thank you, Atiyah.
Thank you.
We're going to go into our last break and I'll be back to close out the show.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first of its kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thank you, as always, to our watch team of corporate partners for bringing us their content and contributions to the show. I hope you all have a great week.